If you were to take a look at what the Golden Globes race looks like today, you will see expensive vessels decked out with the best and lightest devices to allow the captains sailing to easily talk with their team and family members by phone and email. Weather maps and updates are no longer spread across a makeshift desk and to be guessed upon, and GPS tracking ensures that not only participants can't get lost, but they also can't send false locations. In addition to this, if trouble arrives and captains need help, a helicopter is hours away. Circulating the world in 100 days or less, the participants race each other no longer to be the first, but to be the fastest, and each and every one of them sails through the most dangerous waters in the world. Exactly the same route as the first participants of this race, the first whom set out to sail alone, nonstop around the world in 1968. And here they had to meet their best and worst selves, alone, without solace, and without help. And who they were in their core dictated their success. After 10 months, the race would conclude with only one man returning to port. The others would fail in varying degrees of simply giving up, deciding not to go home, and falling into madness and death. Welcome back to Tragedy with a View. I am your host, Kayla. And
I'm Sam.
Sam is back.
An honored co-host.
And also known as Samuel, because I just talked with the other Sam, and she did the exclusive episode with me, and I realized that I needed a better way to identify which Sam it was with me. And so she was like, oh, just call me Samantha. And I was like, oh, that's a good idea.
That used to be my nickname, Samantha.
Was it?
It was not a good nickname.
It was
Green bullying. Eggs and Ham.
Green Eggs and Ham.
Sam, Green Eggs and Ham. That was another one.
Okay. I thought you were implying that Samantha and Green Eggs and Ham were connected, but okay.
Speaking, so there is a... The Golden Globes is a race that happens every year, annually?
Yes. And actually, the first American woman just this year, it wasn't the same race, but she just completed going around the world in a very similar fashion just like a month or so ago, which I like happened to find her on Instagram while I was reading the book. And so it was kind of fun to see because the book goes into detail about how racers were doing things in the 60s versus what you see now. So that was a cool comparison.
Do you know how many people participate now?
I do not. I know, I don't think it's held every year. I think the next one is 2025. If I remember correctly, I kind of just Googled it real quick to make sure that it was something that continued, and it has. But so we are going to start with July 10th of 1969, when a Royal Mail vessel was in the middle of the Atlantic between Europe and the Caribbean when they spotted a sailboat. Curious, they slowed and approached the boat. Tiegmoth Electron was painted on the side indicating its name, but it was unmanned. A worker on the mail vessel happened to recognize the name as he was standing next to his captain and took off as soon as he realized why. When he returned, he was holding a paper outlining the latest news of the Golden Globe race, and a photo covering the front page was none other than Donald Crowhurst and his boat, Tiegmoth Electron, which was supposed to be, or it was estimated to win the race. So in 1966, 3 years prior, a man by the name of Francis Chichester would set out to sail alone around the world, and he only stopped once in Australia, completing his goal in 1967. And apparently in the sailing world, and I'm assuming this is not just in the sailing world, but especially at this time, men in the sailing world had extremely large egos. And when
do they not? My sister told me a fact this morning when we were talking. She said that apparently 20% of men that have never picked up a tennis racket think that they can beat Serena Williams in one point in her prime.
Of course they do.
So speaking of men ego.
Of course they do. Okay. Well, when the sailing community learned that Chichester only stopped once, the drive to do it nonstop was born. As the quest for the nonstop voyage became apparent, London's Sunday Times newspaper would begin to try to find a way to jump on this without making it a race from start to finish. They worried that if they had a hard start date and presented the race too close to a real race, that the men driving for this goal to be the first to race nonstop around the world would not enter the race. But they needed to do something before competing newspapers edged them out, so they came up with a different idea. The Sunday Times would go on to dub this the Golden Globe Race. There was no entry required, simply by starting at a point in the British Isles between the dates of June 1st, 1968 and October 31st, 1968, sailing down the Atlantic, rounding south of Africa past Cape Good Hope, Cape Leeuwin in Australia, and Cape Horn of South America before heading back up the Atlantic and returning to their port, which would make them eligible for the reward. In addition to this, participants...
The reward. What was it?
We'll get there.
Okay.
So, in addition to this, participants had to sail alone, without assistance, without accepting supplies, without stopping, and without pulling into a port. A trophy would be awarded to the first home, and a 5,000-pound reward would be given to the fastest one to complete the voyage.
Logan has taught me today that... if there's no reward, there's no point in doing it.
Kayla, it's all for the t-shirts, okay?
Kayla tried to get him to run a race this year, and he's asked, what do I get for doing it?
Is it something shiny?
Well,
it is not.
Apparently, these men may get something shiny if they finish. And glory.
So in 1968, 5,000 pounds is equal to 6,311 United States dollars. And the value of a British pound from 1968 is increased. So
adjusting for inflation, as you know, inflation has increased recently. So the calculation is a little bit more difficult. We would know. We're trying to find a house.
And it is hard. So 5,000 pounds today is equivalent. Would you like to guess?
100,000.
You are very close. 108,650 pounds.
That's quite a pretty penny.
That is a very...
to win the Golden Globe.
Very pretty penny.
And that even doesn't even count the accolades associated with being the first to navigate around the world without stopping.
Mm-hmm. On March 17th, 1968, the Sunday Times announced its intent to cover the race, provided the prizes, and outlined the rules. One of the requirements was how captains had to go around the world, and they had to start in the Atlantic in the British and European ports. There are a lot of ships, like almost alleyways between Europe and America, Europe, South America, Africa, and whatnot through the Atlantic, because the large cargo ships essentially had...
Are you talking about like channels? Like the Panama Canal?
No. Oh. It's not like a landlocked channel. It's just the path that it was like... the ships knew that if they stayed on like this direction, they would make it to X port.
follow the current.
So because of this, the first and last part of the voyage would require the men to be awake for days on end because there was no way for them to have some sort of alarm system to let them know if a ship was in the same path that they were on. So they would sit awake and keep an eye for boats coming their way, and they would have to navigate to keep themselves safe. At this time, the radar had just begun to be used by larger and more tech-supported ships. However, small wooden boats like...
Sonar? Sorry.
What's the difference between radar and sonar?
I would think that radar is... That's a good question.
Well, radar or sonar? Because I'm not sure if they were looking like through this like air or through the water. That's a good point. So either way, small wooden boats like the ones that these men were using did not show up very well on the radar or the sonar, and that's only if they showed up at all. Along with this, when you're on a boat, you are only able to see about 3 miles ahead of you on super clear days, and because of the Earth's curve, anything beyond this, especially small boats, are over the horizon.
That's weird that that's 3 miles versus like viewing distance on land supposedly is 10 miles.
It's probably because of the water. Water has more give than...
Well, like changing height, yeah.
Land. Well, so as the, you know, the moon affects the tides, right? So as the moon's going around the Earth, the water is actually pulled up towards the moon and it follows it. So as the moon is going like over the ocean, there's a little bit of an oblong shape to it rather than, you know, it just being a distinct curve.
That's interesting. I did not know that.
Learn something new every day.
That's the goal.
So because of this, some men would sit up on the deck of their boats and keep an eye out, and others would go down in their cabins and come out every 20 or 30 minutes to have a look around them. They then must drive south out of the Atlantic into the Southern Ocean and go around the three capes, Cape of Good Hope of Africa, Cape Leeuwin of Australia, and Cape Horn of South America. When you pass from the Pacific to the Atlantic and through Drake's Passage, which is a 600-mile pass between South America and Antarctica, it is known to have some of the roughest sailing conditions in the world.
600 miles?
It is 600 miles, the span of water.
That doesn't seem very big.
It is not. It is the smallest land point-to-point in the world, in the ocean at least. So the...
Bet you there's penguins.
In South America?
Chile in Antarctica? I feel like I seen something where there's penguins in South, like the south tip of South America.
There might be.
Because
I know there's...
They like can... Well, it would make sense because it's short travel.
Well, I know that there's penguins in South Africa. So it also makes sense that...
Probably.
So anyways, this Drake's Passage is known as the graveyard of the ocean. Sailors knew prior to the Panama Canal that if they entered Drake's Pass, there was potential that they would never make it out. In Drake's Passage, waves can reach 100 feet high, large hail is common, and immense volumes of sleet, snow, and ice-like fog accompanies the area once you break 40 degrees south. This passage is worse than others, in part because it is the narrowest point between land masses with the same amount of water trying to move through it. Every second, the equivalent of 500 Amazon rivers pass through the span of the 600 miles.
That's crazy. It's surprising that you hear about like the Bermuda Triangle, but this is probably like the actual realistic dangerous place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like no one talks about that.
Yeah. According to statistics from 2015, 20,000 sailors have lost their lives in Drake's Passage and over 800 shipwrecks. And this is just in the recordable history, which I believe dates back to the early 1800s.
That is a lot.
And that's just what's recorded. It's not, you know, incidents where people kind of didn't be honest with how many people were on board.
Call it Drake's Locker.
Or, I wonder if that's a thing.
Probably.
So, the other capes have similar effects. They're just less violent. In total, 9 would end up declaring their intent to compete in the Golden Globes, and these men included John Ridgway, who was 29 and was a captain in the British Army, Che Blyth, who was 27 and was a former British Army sergeant, and he and John Ridgway had actually been partners in a transatlantic row. Robin Knox Johnson, who was a merchant marine captain for Britain, Bernard Motessier, who was 45 and was a French sailor and author, Loke Fogarin, who was 42 and the manager of a motorcycle company in Morocco, France, Bill King, at 57, was a farmer but previously was a British Navy submarine commander, Nigel Tetley, who was 45 and a Royal Navy lieutenant, Alex Carozo, who was 36 and had previously sailed alone across the Pacific, and then finally there was Donald Crowhurst, who was 36 and an electronic engineer.
All right, making my prediction. I'm going to take the farmer.
The farmer? Okay.
That's my random guess. Only one person makes it, right?
Only one person makes it.
All right, that's my guess. Alex Carozo sounds familiar.
We talked about him.
Okay.
So soon, each and every one of these men would be vying for sponsorship from any company they could find in order to partake in this race. We are going to talk about each of these men individually in their journey. So a lot of the time, obviously, a lot of the time is going to kind of intersect with each other, especially because there was a June start date and October 31st was the last date that you could leave to be entered in this race. And I'll give you a spoiler. Some of these men drop out before that end date option.
Definitely not the farmer. The farmer is going to leave. He's going to make it out.
So John Ridgway was a captain in the British Army and his focus was on the parachute regime, and he and Che Blyth had together rowed across the Atlantic in 1966. While he had experienced rowing on boats, he had very little sailing experience, and all of his experience had been done with others aboard. John had originally been planning to ease his way into a nonstop trip around the world by himself by entering into an O-Star race in 1968 and then starting his solo circumnavigation the following year in 1969. Hearing about the Golden Globe, he bailed on this original idea and jumped in headfirst to the Golden Globe race. At 11:38 a.m. on June 1st, 1968, John sailed from the Aran Islands just off the coast of Northwest Ireland and officially became the first sailor to leave. He quickly ran into problems when both a camera boat carrying the BBC newscasters along with the INT boat, which had his wife on board, came up alongside him, and both of these boats collided with him.
Jeez.
For clarity, it was one after the other, but after the second, the rubber rail near the rigging had some cosmetic damage to it, and while the damage was only in appearance, John still felt rather unhinged by this experience so quickly after leaving the docks. The rub rail is meant to absorb impact when the hull of the boat or ship is in a collision, so it is an important piece of equipment in the shipping alleys. But a couple of weeks later, on June 16th, everything seemed to be going all right. John was to sail alongside his journalist, Bill Gardner, who was with his sponsor, The People, which is another newspaper outlet, and this time he would hand over letters and photographs detailing his journey so far. For a few minutes, they were able to shout to each other, and they used a line strung between the two boats to pass items to each other. Bill Gardner...
That sounds like it's against the rules.
Yes.
Ah!
For everyone who does not know Sam personally, he's
this guy is going to get disqualified.
He follows the rules, so...
The rules give us freedom to explore the boundaries.
Regardless, Bill Gardner sent him letters, newspapers, some bread, cheese, sardines, and...
What? Get this guy out of here.
And beer. And they agreed that 3.5 right. months...
If this guy isn't disqualified, I'm done.
3.5 months later, so in October, they would meet off the shores of Bluff, New Zealand. In these few short minutes, John felt so connected to a person that when he was again alone on his boat, the overwhelming feeling of loneliness came over him, and he started to realize that maybe he didn't have the mental capacity to do this all by himself, for what would it take approximately a year? When John was 600 miles east of Brazil, he noticed the deck of his boat was starting to bulge around the plate that connected to the deck that held the lines to support the mast.
So he hasn't even, he's not made it around Africa yet.
No, he's still in the Atlantic at this point. They sailed much slower.
Well, I'm just, I didn't know if we were moving faster than I thought.
Nope, he's still in the Atlantic. So this plate that was connected to the deck that held the lines to support the mast is secured to the deck by screws that go all the way through to the underside of the deck. To try to reinforce this, he added plywood to the underside and re-screwed the plate down. The following morning, though, he saw that the reinforcement was now bowing under the pressure of the plate and mast. After determining there was nothing he could do to fix this, and it was simply a problem of having a boat not meant for the ocean, he pulled into a port in Recife, Brazil, on July 21st and officially withdrew from the race.
Okay, so July 21st, we lasted a month and a half.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, well, he would have been disqualified anyway, the cheater.
Oh, just wait. As mentioned above, Che had rowed with John Ridgway across the Atlantic, and while John had a decent amount of experience inside of a boat and on the water, Che did not. In fact, his only real experience was that single row with John.
Well, speaking of the row, interesting thing. You know what we should do? We should join the Rogue Challenge. Have you seen that?
Rogue?
So Rogue Fitness.
Yes.
They do a rowing challenge where it's like you row with a team of four people the same distance as like rowing across the ocean over 24 hours. I don't know which ocean, Pacific or Atlantic, but it's like a 24-hour challenge they do every year.
Wow, sounds like so much
Kayla
fun.
Kayla wants
we
to do it. She's signing up, everyone.
I'm Googling it right now. We need to get...
I see her. Look, she's typing it in right now.
We need
now.
To get Sam
see
and Amanda.
Her face.
Tim and Amanda.
No, Ben.
Ben? Oh, Ben.
Ben's good at rowing.
Let's get Ben. Okay. Nonetheless...
But he's got heart, right?
Che had quite the support system around him, and when he announced that he was going... to try sailing alone around the world, he was offered a boat by a company that really just wanted to have one of their boats tested in ocean waters. And when he revealed his lack of experience, rather than people trying to talk some sense into him and suggesting that maybe he wait for another time, everyone rallied and tried to teach him as much as they possibly could to prepare him for what the Southern Ocean was like. On June 8th...
What a great support system he has.
Right? On June 8th, Che set sail, officially launching for the Golden Globe, and after being on the water for 6 miles completely on his own, he found that he had no idea where he was. Because he didn't have a solid understanding of navigation, he knew generally where he was, but he had no idea how to read the map or how to place himself on the map. On the plus side, he had a calm first 3 weeks on the water, but on July 1st, he had his first taste of bad weather, and he found that the boat was completely unmanageable. In addition to this, he was starting to realize how poor of a boat he had while receiving he had received for this ocean voyage. And while he was still unsure about where he was, he also could not get his radio to work, which added to his anxiety. In addition to this, he soon realized that his gas storage had been contaminated from the salt water, and this gas was used to power his radio, navigation, and lights. He then saw an anchored ship and set off a distress flare, and quickly a small boat was launched from the larger ship and met Che in the ocean. After talking for a moment, Che boarded the small boat and made friends with the captain, Neil McAllister, who assisted Che in every way that he could.
Foreshadowing.
On August 27th, he found himself in a vicious storm as he approached the Southern Ocean.
Wait, he got back on his ship?
He got back on his boat, yes.
Oh.
So Che would then be tossed around for 3 days, and then finally, 1 week later, he sailed into the Southern Ocean. Che, while inexperienced, caught on quickly and was doing everything he could to run his boat as fast and as hard.
So he made it. He's heading toward Africa right now.
He is, yes.
Good. Okay.
Yes.
He's made it a lot farther than I thought.
Yes.
Good on him.
So Che was running his boat as fast and hard as he could. He essentially was trying to break his boat while he was closer to land so that if something happened, there is a chance that it wouldn't end in catastrophe. Nearing September, Che again rode out another storm and would come to Port Elizabeth in South Africa. He docked and waited for some spare parts to arrive in 4 days.
What in the world is going on with all these cheaters? These cheetahs. They got spots and everything.
It's okay. After he received his parts, he would then set sail again, and he experienced yet another storm with gale-force winds, and within 48 hours, he decided that he had had enough and turned around to head back to Port Elizabeth.
Right. So how long did he last?
Sometime in September. So
September to
June 8th. Through, I would call it two, 3 months.
So he lasted longer than the other guy.
Yes.
That's where heart gets you. And a good support system.
A great support system.
I want everyone to know that I'm having a flat face.
Cheetahs. So we're going to move on to Fogeron, who was
cool name. Is that his first name?
It's his last name. Loke. Oh. Is his...
Is it like spelled like lock, but loke?
L-O-I-C-K. Oh.
Okay.
So he was friends with Bernard Montessier, and they had previously sailed together. In port near Plymouth, he and Bernard had anchored their boats across the harbor channel from each other, and as fog rolled in, they shouted to each other about their plans. Fogeron decided that he was going to chance it in the fog rather than leave a couple of days later and have the winds blowing against him. He would leave port on August 22nd, and he brought his cat on board. Unfortunately, as we know, his cat, like many others, was a little feisty and was eating through the bags that he had stored his food in, and she then chewed through some of the wiring for his radio.
Great.
And he also started to believe that she might have been pregnant. He was really scared that she was going to have kittens on his boat, so he decided when he finally came close to a fishing boat off of Cape Verde Islands on September 20th, he handed his cat over to the boat to get her off of his.
What in the world is wrong with these people?
They're having a
it's like,
grand
oh,
time.
Oh, wow. I love my cat so much that I'm going to bring him along. And then he just goes ahead and gives him away.
Yeah. I mean,
what
things change.
Weirdos.
Things change. You meet your best and worst self.
He is also a cheetah. So.
Now, moving on, the captain of this boat that took the cat in originally was like, okay, I'll go ahead and keep her. But then he quickly found out that this cat was way too destructive, and he put an ad in the newspaper to get rid of her. On August...
What was the cat's name?
I don't know.
What was their name?
I don't know. It didn't say. So on October 31st, Fogaron experienced his first knockdown in rough seas shortly after he had gone to bed that night. He rushed up on deck after his boat came back upright and was happy to see that no damage had been done. And as if this was a moment of divine intervention, he changed his course, and on November 27th, he sailed into Cape Town and was officially out of the race.
Okay, so he, August 22nd to November.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what is that, 8 to 11, then 3 months? Got it.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, that's a pretty long time still.
To be alone on a boat? Yeah.
Well, some of them.
One of them had a cat.
Not the first guy. First guy literally had his wife following him around.
Well, she was just in the channel, the English channels.
And they were trading alcoholic beverages. Like, come on. But still, that's
he was alone most of the time.
That's a pretty long time.
So Bill King, who joined the Royal Navy when he was only 14 years old, had gained a significant amount of experience in the process. He served through the entire World War II and was the first man to fly off of a deck of a ship in an airplane in the Royal Navy.
Nice. That's super cool.
He would later go on to be a submarine commander, and he had experience racing yachts with friends on his own boat called the Galloway Blazer. He had raced across the Atlantic as well as through the West Indies. When Bill heard about Chichester's voyage and that he only stopped in Australia, he realized that he could probably sail alone around the world without stopping, much like the others. As soon as the idea came into his mind, he couldn't get rid of it. He would have a new boat built, and he would call this one the Galloway Blazer 2.
Bill, wow, creative.
Right? Bill left from the same port as Fogaron, but 2 days later, on August 24th, and he had mostly calm weather until the end of October. For 2 days, he battled through the most violent weather he had ever sailed through when it finally eased on October 31st. He felt grateful to have made it.
Halloween.
As he went out on deck to make sure there wasn't any severe damage, a wave hit the side of his boat, lifted her into the air before lowering her sail first into the water. His boat was completely upside down. Bill, already trying to work through what to do, was shocked when another wave again lifted his boat and set her back right side up. Back below deck, Bill closed the hatch and started pumping water out of his boat, knowing his race was done and that his boat would not survive the Southern Ocean. On November 21st, he sailed into port and out of the race.
Another 3 months, okay.
Alex Carozzo was a merchant navigator and mainly taught himself how to sail and traverse open waters. He was the first Italian to sail from Tokyo to San Francisco, crossing the Pacific Ocean. Essentially preparing for this race completely on his own, Alex was using every second of his time to make sure his boat was in working order and he had everything he needed to make the one-year voyage on the waters.
Do you know? So there seems to be a lot of these people that are doing like cross Atlantic or cross Pacific in this guy's sense. Sorry. Cross Pacific in this sense. How long did that voyage take?
I don't know off the top of my head.
Like maybe like a month. I wonder if that's like the threshold. Like let's say that took 3 months. It's like all these people are only used to traveling for that period of time. And then they just give up afterwards.
Yeah, so that's actually a pretty common theme with a lot of the competitors is that they realize how alone they are and how much they like the idea of winning this race, but not actually enjoying being on the water. And that becomes a problem for clearly the people who are already out of the race.
I think my farmer is going to make it. Farmer's got this, unless she ordered them in a specific way.
I did order them in a specific
way. Oh, man.
So.
Boo. Okay, well, my farmer is going to come in second. Watch, he's going to be like the first one to drop out really quick.
I need to remember which one is the farmer. Bill King is already out.
What? Oh, man. Okay, well, too bad. I mean, as long as he wasn't the first guy. He
was not, no.
Okay.
Oh, no.
He survived three months? He's the first guy?
No, Bill King was the guy who...
Had the cat?
No, he was the one who was the first man to fly off of the deck of a ship in British Navy. So we're moving on to Alex Carozzo now, who essentially prepared for this race completely on his own. Alex was using every second of his time to make sure that his boat was in working order, and he set sail on October 31st, the last day to be able to leave port to enter the Golden Globe race. And he, unfortunately, did not last long. He had suffered from stomach ulcers in the past, and he actually had surgery because of these ulcers. And when they flared up shortly after setting sail, he was forced to stop in Lisbon when he could not stop vomiting blood. The ulcers were likely due to stress, and on November 14th, he was done.
Lisbon, where's that at? Is that Europe?
Yes.
Okay.
So he left. He made it 2 weeks.
Well, my farmer guy beat that guy.
We are moving on to my favorite sailor, Montesir, Bernard Montesir. And I want to mention that I typically try really hard not to put my own, like, emotional agenda into these stories. I like to try to keep it as close to the facts as possible. But I put in two notes in his particular part, and
guys, I think I'm going to learn something tonight.
No, you're going to be like, this is so typically Kayla.
Well, then something is going to be reinforced in my belief system.
So Bernard Montesir was born in Vietnam, but this was when it was still called French Indochina. He served in World War II in a gunboat with the French fighting against Indochina, and then when his home became overcame with war, he bought a boat and sailed away. He ended up losing his boat after he ran aground on the Chagos Bank located in the Indian Ocean, and he spent 3 years in Mauritius, where he spent time building yet another boat. He then sailed off into the Caribbean, where he lost this boat, and this time he ended up working his way to Hamburg before settling in France. It was here that a friend offered to build him a boat that was a little bit more solid and built out of steel plates, and in doing so, Bernard would call this boat Joshua. Bernard would take his wife sailing, and they went all over the world. To Tahiti, where they sailed through the Panama Canal to reach the Pacific, but on their return, they sailed through the Southern Ocean and around Cape Horn. Because of this, it didn't take as long, and their trip to Tahiti took an entire Their trip to Tahiti took a full year to make, going through the Panama Canal. Their trip coming back, because where Tahiti is located, they went through the Southern Ocean, and it only took them 4 months. It also helped that they didn't stop to visit any other locations on the way. And though their trip was through the Southern Ocean was a rough one with typical storms, the wind-powered steering gear that Bernard was using was also useless, so he ended up steering by hand. This storm lasted an entire week, but this voyage would also become the longest nonstop voyage at that time, taking them from Tahiti to Spain, which is 14,216 miles or 22,878 kilometers, and it wasn't because they wanted to, they just really missed their kids.
So this guy got a record without trying?
Yes.
What a Chad.
Bernard heard about the Golden Globe race, and while he first presented his thoughts on the race as being foolish and exactly the kind of response the Sunday Times feared, by the time he ended his rant, he was already thinking about doing it. Montesir, like Fogeron, left port on August 22nd, and right away he was averaging a whopping 150 miles per day. And with that average, there was a good chance that he not only would catch up to those who started before him, but also wave to the others as he passed by and won the race. Bernard absolutely refused to carry a radio with him because he thought that it would take away from the experience. And because of this, what his path looked like day to day is unknown. Because of his prior experience on the Southern Ocean going around Cape Horn, he learned that going fast was the best way to get through rough waters. And as he approached the Southern Ocean, he started to look around his cabin to see if there was anything that he might be able to get rid of to lighten his boat. He started out by throwing...
This guy. All right. Okay.
He started out by throwing overboard a box of biscuits, a case of condensed milk.
Oh my God.
25 bottles of wine. And that's my first note. I put in parentheses the audacity. Who gets rid of that much wine?
He was having a good time.
Who gets rid of that much wine? You're going to have a good time drinking wine.
Who gets rid of your food?
He also got rid of 45 pounds of rice, 10 pounds of sugar.
How was he going to make it? Was he planning on stopping? Like another cheetah?
Oh, just wait. This guy's a rock star, okay? So he got rid of 45 pounds of rice, 10 pounds of sugar, 30 pounds of jam, boxes of batteries, 4 jerry cans of kerosene, and nylon line that weighed roughly 60 pounds. On October 20th, Bernard came close to another boat where he was going to throw some film and letters and notes aboard to send back to the Sunday Times, but the boat came too close and ended up colliding. Luckily, the damage that was done was able to be repaired within a couple of days. But despite this hard life of sailing on the oceans, Bernard was having a phenomenal experience. At one point, he was sailing near the Stewart Islands, which is in New Zealand, and a large school of porpoises arrived around his boat, and they were making a ton of noise. And
dude, this guy is like Captain Jack... whatever his last name is.
Sparrow?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm saying whatever his name was. This guy's building his own boats, drinking wine, having a bunch of porpoises.
Yeah. This guy. And they were playing and clicking in the water around him. They were leaping clear of the water, and the school ended up staying with him for 3 hours.
What an experience.
And we're not done. On January 21st, as Bernard made his descent toward Cape Horn, he, like many others, started to experience the rough waters and spent much of his time on deck tending to different parts that were breaking and needing repair. Here, on a calm and clear night, Bernard saw something quite unique. So apparently the moon can sometimes do something funny looking due to where you are in the southern hemisphere. And... as well as the moon's orientation. And what happens is when the moon is in a crescent shape and it starts to come over the horizon, you will start by seeing just the tips of the crescent. And as it comes up farther, it looks like glowing horns are coming out of the water. So Bernard's...
that is crazy.
Right? So Bernard sees this really weird looking light and he thinks, oh, this is just the moon. But in actuality, the light he saw... as the sun was setting, then exploded throughout the night sky in shades of pinks and blues and greens. What he was seeing is the Aurora Australis, or the Southern Lights. They're even more rare to see than the Northern Lights because you have to be lower in the southern hemisphere in order to see them, and the best place to see them is Tasmania. Would you like to guess what my second note is in this particular part?
Tasmania?
Promptly adds Tasmania to the list.
Oh. Well, I thought Tasmania was in Africa.
It's
in South America?
It's Australia. So.
I didn't know there were Southern Lights.
Yeah. I didn't know it either. Mm. On February 5th, 1969, he passed Cape Horn and was well on his way home. Until he realized that finishing the race would make him a hero in the eyes of France. And it was in this moment he bailed on the race and kept sailing east. On March 18th, he sailed into Cape Town in Africa and sent a message to the Sunday Times that essentially said that he was not going to finish the race and continue on, not to break a record, but because he was happy at sea.
What?
Yeah.
So he sailed around the world.
He sailed around the world. And then he was
and
like...
And then he said...
I'm going to keep going.
Nah, I'm going to keep going.
I really like it here.
So he's just leaving everything behind. He's just like, I'm going to sail.
Yeah. There's pictures in the book. The book is called A Voyage of Mad Men. And the pictures in the book, there's a few of him. Like,
does he look like Captain Jack Sparrow? Does he have long hair?
No. I mean, he does have long hair, but he's got like long hair and a beard. And he's in like these flowy yoga pants. And he does meditations on his boat. And they're like... I'm looking at it. I'm like, wow, this guy is so like, he knows himself so deeply that he just doesn't care. And he doesn't match with like all of the other men who are sailors in this particular race, who are all in their like thick knitted sweaters and pants and sail boots. And like they have like that. What's the word I want to use?
Swagger.
Yeah, swab. Like there's like a very specific style I feel like sailors wear, and it's evident in the other pictures of all the other guys who like you look at and you're like, yeah, I definitely see them being sailors. And then there's just this guy who's like hippy dippy long messy hair.
I mean, I was gonna say, it's like I thought there was gonna be more flower children, but it seems like we got one.
All right. At 44, Nigel Tetley, who was a commander in the Royal Navy, had less than 1 year before retirement when he heard about the Golden Globe race. At one point in his life, he had considered sailing around the world, but when he met his wife, that idea quickly became a well-envisioned idea rather than something he would ever plan for. But then one morning, when he read about the Golden Globe and saw the newspaper outlining the rules, he suddenly felt the pull again to accomplish this dream. He was sitting with his wife at the time, and he cautiously slid the paper over to her and then asked, "May I go?" His wife, Eve, read the article and then looked at her husband for what he says felt like forever, and she just stared at him before responding, "I will not try to stop you." He then went out trying to figure out a way to convince the Royal Navy to release him 5 months earlier than his retirement date, so that way he could set sail in September. He already had a boat, and while it was in need of repairs, he had some time before his September launch date would arrive. His boat was a multi-hull, which means that instead of one single section of boat, there's essentially two sailboats that are connected in the center by a cabin.
What?
Is
it like a pontoon boat sort of thing?
No.
Is the cabin sideways and the boats are facing forward? Are they like parallel with each other? Or
yes.
Are they...
So Nigel set sail on September 16th, and he had twin sails attached to the main mast of his boat. And unfortunately, this same evening while he was pulling the twin sails up, one of the sails got caught up in the severe wind and ended up snapping the mast off at the top. It took him a couple of days, but he was able to repair it. And at some point, he checked below the floorboards of his cabin and found it full of water.
We're starting off great.
He had inadvertently been sailing with about 800 extra pounds of water. He was able to pump the water out and mostly repair the leak, but he decided that he was going to keep checking that area from now on. On December 23rd, Nigel entered into the Southern Ocean, and while he was an experienced sailor with what to expect here, he stayed prepared and went to bed fully dressed in his rain gear and sea boots, so that way if something happened, he would be able to get up and get to work right away.
Smart man.
About a month later, he was just west of Australia and was fighting through a fierce storm when his boat was tossed on its side and the force of the boat hitting the water smashed all of the windows on one side of his cabin. Despite this, the next day when the storm had passed and his boat had been pulled back upright by another wave, he was surprised to find that there wasn't any damage done besides the windows.
So there's been multiple, like, capsizings.
Yes.
So are these people just, like, rolling around in their boat while this happens? Like, some is that what's happening?
Some of them, yes.
Okay.
So he...
just like casually saying, oh, my boat capsized and then it came back. All right, time to keep going. I feel like I'd be like, okay, well, that was fun.
I mean, what else are you supposed to do?
I don't know. Good on them. Brave men.
So he had multiple similar events, and on March 4th, he experienced the worst yet. The plywood that he had placed over the windows broke under the pressure and again flooded his cabin. This time, though, once back upright, Nigel had to bail water out by hand, reapply the plywood over his windows, and when he finally made it to daylight, he could see the damage done to the exterior and found some pretty serious problems. For one, the hull frame on the starboard side, or the left side, was broken. Next, he found the top of the cabin had been separated from the rest of the boat. And finally, the main hull had been splintering and was twisted. In this condition, he continued to sail on towards land, but he knew that he was out of the race. He somehow managed to sail past Cape Horn 2 weeks later. He then kept going, and on April 22nd, 7 weeks after his boat was badly damaged, he more or less crossed the same point as when he was in the very beginning of the race, meaning that he successfully sailed all the way around the world and was the first to do so in a multi-hull.
Dang.
Because he was sailing with some ease despite the damage done to his boat, he basically decided to sail on as far as he could. But at the end of May, Nigel encountered yet another storm, and this time, when he woke in the middle of the night due to a scraping sound, he knew it was bad. The port bow, or the right side of his boat, had broken off, and in doing so, smashed a hole into the main hull, and his boat was sinking.
Oh, good.
He made a mayday call, grabbed some important items, and then got into his life raft. He sat in the life raft and watched as the violent water pulled his boat under, and it took nearly 18 hours, but he was finally picked up by a British petroleum ship.
Where was he at when this happened? Ship.
He was in the Atlantic. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, it must have been pretty north, right? Like, he finished, right? Dang, I didn't think that guy was going to make it.
Yeah,
that guy was struggling.
Yeah, we got two more left.
All right. That's fine. I'm just impressed.
Robin Knox Johnson, who was 17 when he wanted to join the Royal Navy. He ended up failing the exams required to be admitted, so he became an apprentice for the British India Steam Navigation Company and became a merchant captain instead. His time here allowed him to learn how to navigate with a sextant and would travel all over from East Africa to India, to the Persian Gulf, and then back to London. While stationed in Bombay, he and a few friends decided to have a yacht built, and they would call her Swahili. Robin decided to buy out his friends and took full ownership of the boat, and would then sail her from India to Cape Town, South Africa, with his brother and another officer on board. From Cape Town, he then sailed to England. Robin started contemplating the potential for a solo trip around the world without stopping when he and his father had been eating breakfast and reading the paper together one morning. His father commented about Chichester's trip around the world and another man who had recently won the O-Star race and commented, "I wonder if he's going to try to beat Chichester's time or perhaps even go around nonstop. That's all there's left to do, isn't it?" It took 1 month, and Robin was committing himself to the trip of a solo voyage around the world without stopping.
I mean, this guy seems sort of prepared. He's done decent length voyages.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That look is not very promising.
He would put his boat up for sale in order to pay for a new yacht to be made that he could handle.
Sailboat.
They're essentially the same thing in the 1960s.
Okay. Good to know.
So he wanted a new boat that could handle the rough southern seas. To prepare this boat, he installed a self-steering gear that was powered by the wind so that if there was any wind at all, it would be able to keep his boat heading in the correct direction. The wind vane that was used would help to keep the rudder pointing in the right direction by kind of acting as a block. So that way, as the rudder tried to move side to side, it wouldn't be able to swing like fully one direction or the other.
Oh.
On June 14th, Robin would set sail from Falmouth, Cornwall, which is the most western harbor in southern England, and he was the third participant to leave for the Golden Globe. Unlike the others who struggled with being alone, Robin found ways to entertain himself, and one of those ways was to jump overboard and swim next to his boat if the day and the water was warm enough.
Okay. Wow, we're starting off smart. This is so smart. This sounds like the greatest idea you could ever have.
Even though everything was running smooth to the outside world, the bilges were continuing to fill with water, and Robin was having to pump them dry twice a day. He knew that it was coming from the same leak that he had experienced on a prior voyage, but this time it was worse. In response to this, Robin would put on a mask and snorkel, jump overboard so that way he could inspect the hull under the water. Once there, he immediately noticed that there was a gap in the seams between the planks and that as his boat rolled back and forth in the waves, he could see how they were opening and closing with every little movement. To fix this, he got some cotton canvas, which he cut into long, narrow strips and then tacked them into place between the moving pieces of wood with a hammer. He then got back on board where he prepared strips of copper to be hammered over the top of the canvas strips. Once he finished with his repair, it took about 2 days for him to notice that the leaking had pretty much stopped completely.
These guys are so resourceful.
Yeah.
It just reminds me of, like, these guys are like the people that climb mountains. Like, the whole, we watched the Everest, not Everest, but it was like started with an M.
Oh.
Maru. So it's a documentary about these guys climbing, and literally they're one of the poles in their like little tent that hangs off the mountain broke.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have no other option. And it's like these guys come up with the most ingenious things to fix their stuff.
Well, if you don't, you die.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's just like, it's, you know, it's crazy what they come up with. It's like, it's cool.
Yeah, it is. So by August, Robin was just north of Cape Town, South Africa, and he was rapidly approaching the Southern Ocean. He was inconvenienced, however, because the brakes on the device that maintained the sails on the mast was not working properly. And while he was trying to do any work with the sails at all, whether it be putting them up or pulling them in, the brake system would give out and drop the fabric on his head. It wasn't until August 27th that he experienced his first real storm, and it only lasted 24 hours. On September 5th, Robin encountered yet another storm, and this time it was severe and put his boat on its side. The boat was able to right itself before Robin was fully able to free himself from under the mess that was now inside his cabin. But then the boat violently lurched back on its side again, before righting itself and tossing Robin as well as all of his belongings around. Because of this, his cabin started to take on water and was flooding, and the first thing that Robin needed to do was get out on deck and make sure that everything there was where it needed to be. Once he did this, he went back into his cabin and started pumping the water out. This particular storm raged for 2 days, and after this, Robin would start to see a pattern where he would be in a storm and then a couple of days of rest before another violent storm blew in. Shortly after the second storm, Robin decided to start trying to lighten his load a little bit. And while he had been...
Did he throw out 25 cases of wine?
No, thank God. He had been collecting rainwater to drink so that way he could conserve the fresh water that he had packed on his boat. And because he was collecting enough rainwater for him to drink throughout his journey, he decided to get rid of the water that he had stored and quickly found out that both containers that he was using had been contaminated, likely with the salt water when his boat was knocked down in the prior storm. On September 16th, Robin was checking on the batteries that were inside of the engine compartment, and when a wave jerked his boat, it caused battery acid to splash into his left eye. He cried out and went onto the deck of his boat to splash salt water in his eye before he went back below deck and used fresh water and eye drops. He knew that the threat of damage was not over and that the worst part of this at the time was that his eye was stinging, and the only reason he didn't turn back to get medical attention was because he knew that there were others on his tail, and if he didn't stay the course, he would absolutely lose.
Great.
On November 3rd...
Just put an eye patch on it.
Become a real pirate.
Yeah.
On November 3rd, he was about 300 miles from Australia when a shaft to his self-steering gear broke off and there was no way for him to repair it, so he was left to continue on without having that contraption to rely on. On November 18th, he felt his boat collide with something soft and then he stopped moving. He had hit a sand buff and was now stuck. He was close enough to the shore of New Zealand that people came to offer their help, but he insisted that help not be given.
Good for him.
Because that would disqualify him from the race.
Okay, respect on this guy.
While the tide came in and the wind, or when the tide came in and the wind picked up, he was easily able to free himself from the sand. In early January, Robin began his descent towards Cape Horn, which at this point was about 1,500 miles away. It didn't take long for the violent weather to push in. He was always cold and started drinking more whiskey as an attempt to keep himself warm. At one point, he felt his boat jolt, and when he stepped out on deck, he found that the main sail had been split in half along the seam. He knew it would take him a considerable amount of time to repair this, but he had an older one that he decided to put up instead and made himself some oatmeal for breakfast. Unfortunately, while he was preparing the hot oatmeal, the boat jolted again, and this time the hot oatmeal went all over his hand, giving him severe burns. But Robin sailed on, and on January 17th, he passed Cape Horn at 8 p.m., he would enter the Atlantic Ocean shipping lanes again, where he would have to spend more and more time on deck watching for cargo ships, and on the afternoon of April 22nd, nearly 11 months after setting sail, Robin Knox Johnson crossed the finish line, a cannon fired, and at 3:25 p.m., he officially won the very first Golden Globe race.
Nice. That guy went through some...
When
tragedy.
Yeah. When you look at pictures of him, you're like, yeah, he absolutely won this race. Like, he looks like he is a sailor and knows what he's doing and really enjoys it.
Well, I mean,
after
the comments about him, like, going past, you know, Good Hope, Cape of Good Hope and stuff, and to India and all around that stuff, like, he's got a lot of experience.
Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Being young.
Yeah. You have to enjoy the water to be able to do this. So we are going to now move on to the abandoned boat that we started with.
Dun, dun, dun.
At 36 years old, Donald hadn't really had a solid career path in his life. He had been kicked out of both the Royal Air Force as well as the Royal Army. He then worked for an electronics firm, but after he was confronted over an issue that he caused, he quit. He then found work as a design engineer, and while he and his wife lived paycheck to paycheck, he still bought himself a 20-foot boat and started sailing.
Sounds very financially literate.
I agree.
You know what they say? The boat's cheapest when you buy it.
A lot of things are cheapest when you buy it, but boats especially. Yeah. He ended up creating a radio direction finding instrument, which, much like a radio, uses frequency of a known location onshore to help dial in your location offshore. If you have two known locations onshore, the signal can provide a pretty accurate notation of where your actual location is. He called this the Navicator, and while he initially had a buyer to help distribute this device to every single ship in Britain, He found that it wasn't as highly sought after as he thought it would be, and the buyer backed out of the deal.
Sounds pretty cool.
Donald would hear about the race as it was announced in the Sunday Times, and within 4 days, he announced his intent to participate.
Announced his intent. What is this, the presidential race or something?
To him.
Jeez.
But with
Who cares?
But with his background and few sailing accomplishments, everyone kind of overlooked him. He wanted to see if he stood a chance, so he calculated how fast each competitor's boat would sail and created a chart for this. However, what he didn't consider was the actual water and weather. He strictly used the daily averages to determine when each participant would arrive back to port. He determined that he would be the fastest based on the likely max speed of the boats, and that gave him the courage to go all in. He made sure that his boat was rigged with a contraption to prevent his boat from capsizing, which is only a problem if the boat doesn't right itself before the sails go underwater. This contraption involved electrons attached to the side of the boat that, when they got wet, would trigger a mechanism connected to a carbon dioxide cylinder inside of the mast to go off, therefore inflating a buoyancy bag located at the top of the mast. This would prevent it from going completely under the water, and then he could go into the cabin and begin pumping water into the hull of his boat, and this would cause it to become so heavy that it would flip the boat back upright, where he could then pump the water out of the hull. Which, as we've already discussed in the last eight people, isn't that big of a problem.
See, it sounds good in theory.
It sounds great in theory, but...
this guy sounds very... scientific.
He's an engineer.
Yeah.
So while progress was being made on Crowhurst's boat, everyone else was launching and his boat was still barely progressing with being built. Still, he named her Teagmouth Electron and couldn't wait to set sail. Changes were regularly having to be made because of Crowhurst's design, and because of this, things continued to get more expensive, and it was really causing quite a bit of financial strain on not only Crowhurst's family, but it was beginning to get to the point where if he didn't win, they would be financially ruined.
He didn't even have any money to begin with. Jeez.
Tell that to... all of the broke people buying things. On October 30th, after a false start, Crowhurst set sail and was...
false start?
Yeah. He started and then had issues with his boat.
I was going to ask about that. I was curious if, like, as long as they restarted before the end date.
Yes.
Okay, they were allowed to do that?
Yes. Okay. So... Crowhurst set sail and was officially joining the Golden Globe race in a poorly designed boat and without all of the necessary gear on board on October 30th. Some of the gear was intentionally left behind, and others, Crowhurst had asked some of the people working on his boat to make sure that it got on board for him, and unfortunately, these people were not reliable and they did not accomplish the task. It did not take him long to start finding problems with his boat and was bailing water from his boat on a regular basis. He very quickly started to provide false reports for where he was.
Oh, good.
The first week, he reported to his sponsor that he sailed 538 miles. However, he really only sailed 290 miles.
Oh.
This very report would be the first step in what would become the story of what happened to Crowhurst. It can be contemplated that he originally reported miles that he felt confident he could recoup later when he learned how to sail his boat better and faster, but as the list of problems with his boat grew longer, he just continued to dig himself into a hole. One of the problems that he tried to find a way around was the financial ruin that would result in him giving up or losing. Both his home and his business were on the line, and he couldn't afford to lose them both. On December 15th, Crowhurst reported yet another increase in speed, claiming he sailed 243 miles in one day. However, he had really slowed and was barely crawling along. Unsure of what else to do, he created two logbooks. One that included his actual coordinates and miles and location, so that way he always knew where he truly was, and in the other, he calculated his checkpoints that he would be reporting to his sponsor, and therefore the media. He did this because he knew that his logbook would be looked over when he returned, and the really interesting thing about him doing this, though, is that plotting a whole second series of points that are based on calculations would take someone with a really good imagination and mathematical skill set. Crowhurst eventually became stuck in the doldrums, which, if you have listened to episode 13, we talk a little bit about the doldrums. And
is that the Indian Ocean?
No, the doldrums are basically a place in the ocean where there's like no wind and no real water movement, and so you just barely move.
So
at
it's
all.
A phenomenon.
You get stuck in the water, and it's painful to be in. So Crowhurst was experiencing in the Atlantic, where he was stuck in a section of ocean that was 600 to 800 miles wide, that is just along the equator and basically has no wind, so the movement is extremely slow. Still, he was reporting to his sponsor, Rodney Hallworth, that he was averaging over 100 miles per day. The real mileage for one of those days was 13 miles. To everyone back home, they saw these reports coming through, and this was where some of the more experienced sailors, Chichester included, began to wonder if he actually was being honest, because they had all experienced the doldrums, and from what they were seeing, Crowhurst seemed like he just hopped right over them and didn't experience a slowdown at all. It didn't help anyone believe Crowhurst when he wasn't giving latitude and longitude positions. He was just using vague references like off the coast of Brazil or 180 miles until the equator. Another issue that rose for Crowhurst was that when he was sending cables to his sponsor, Rodney, there were at times miscommunications. For example, he had wrote that he was sailing towards Trinidad when he actually meant Trinidad, but when Devon Muse received this, Rodney tried to work out what he actually meant and where he actually was, and realized that there was an island in the South Atlantic called Tristan da Cunha, and realized that that must be where Crowhurst actually was. The problem with this, though, was that this island was almost 2,500 miles past the fake calculation that Crowhurst was providing. Then again, on Christmas Eve, when he was able to talk to his wife, Claire, she asked him for latitude and longitude points, and he said that he hadn't had a chance to check them recently, but he suspected that he was off the shore of Cape Town, which was another huge exaggeration and put him thousands of miles ahead of where he should have been according to his fake register. At this time, the media wasn't really buying into some of the other experts' scrutiny and instead reported these points with excitement and the implication that there was going to be a photo finish ending.
Wow.
Mid-January, he sent a cable that said he was going to do some repairs for his generator, and this would eliminate his ability to communicate with a radio. However, these repairs were not needed, and he shut down the radio and isolated himself from the world. And this was because he just didn't feel like producing fake locations anymore. Yeah. He did, however, figure out when he would approximately be coming around Cape Horn in South America if these fake locations were to be accurate, and about when he would sail home. And so at this point, he decided to kill time and zigzag around the Atlantic until that time came and he could turn around and go home.
Nice.
They're cheetahs.
They're cheetahs with spots and everything. And dull claws.
Mm-hmm.
And only weigh 60 to 80 pounds.
And can easily be killed by a human. Conversation.
That's the next story.
Conversation from another time that apparently I lost. But anyways, during this time, his hull split and was leaking water. And unfortunately, the faster he pushed his boat, the more water was forced through the crack and into his boat. He then ended up running aground off of the Argentine coast. And at this point, he needed to make some repairs. Luckily, the town he was closest to and who towed his boat in and helped him make repairs was very small and mostly off of the grid. They didn't have a phone and they weren't familiar with the Golden Globe race and simply helped him to help him. It was once he was back on the water, he began to spiral. In an unhinged flurry, he began to write, first about philosophy, then Einstein, moral burdens and mathematics, rules and obligations. He wrote about human history and cavemen and society at the time. In the span of 8 days, he wrote 25,000 words.
Nice.
He completely lost track of time and then began writing to try to figure that out. And then, as the very last pages of his logbooks dwindled down, he ended with, "It is time for your move to begin. I have not need to prolong the game. It has been a good game that must be ended with thee. I will play this game when I choose to resign the game. 11, 20, 40. There is no reason for harmful." What happens next is unknown. It has been assumed that Crowhurst took his own life, yet we will never know and we can never for certain understand how he did that. The next event to take place was finding his abandoned boat on July 10th. A search followed, but due to the logbook entry having been from 2 weeks prior, the search was called off the following day. Funds were provided to his wife and young children, and after finding and confirming that Donald Crowhurst had been faking his location the whole time, the Sunday Times still announced the funds would be provided to the family, and they continued to offer their support.
What?
Mm-hmm.
He won?
No.
Oh.
So, Robin Knox Johnson won both awards, and he ended up giving the monetary award to Crowhurst's family.
Oh.
This was prior to them finding his, or scrutinizing his logbooks and realizing that he had been faking the entire time, and the Sunday Times decided to match that amount. So they got double. After the race, many participants struggled. Nigel Tentley hung himself 3 years after being unsuccessful in finding funds to try to make it in another around-the-world race.
Wait, what? Oh, okay.
Loke,
which one was he?
He was the one whose boat broke and sunk.
Oh.
Loke Fogeron and Alex Carozzo disappeared from the public view, and both men were nearly impossible to get an interview with. Bill King tried and tried to successfully complete his trip around the world and finally made it in 1973.
Good for him.
Che Blith would find an understanding in sailing and would sail around the world alone and nonstop in 1971, but he did this going the quote-unquote wrong direction. So he went opposite of the requirements for the Golden Globe race. In June of 1969, Montesir finally made landfall, but then continued to sail all over the world until he passed away in 1994 because of cancer.
Hmm.
Robin Knox Johnson was, of course, celebrated and settled into life as being noble salesman, and in 1995, he was knighted by the Queen.
This is the guy that won.
This is the guy that won.
See, look, he didn't need the money. He literally became a knight.
Yeah.
What a guy.
Yeah.
Did not expect that. I thought you were, I was waiting for the guy that was going to disappear. I was like, all right, is this the guy? See, a lot of things are bad things are happening to this guy. He's going down.
Yeah, so that's the story of the very first Golden Globe race in 1968, 1969.
And in case you're interested, we're about to look up when's the next Golden Globe.
Okay, we will confirm.
So that you guys can go and check it out. Makes me wonder what the current record of traveling around the world is in a sailboat.
Oh, Golden Globe race 2026.
Oh, that's kind of far. Well, see, that gives everyone a chance to, you know, learn about sailing and give it a try yourself. I mean, after hearing these stories, I think I could do it.
Oh, the 2026 Golden Globe race. 21 sailors, 30,000 miles, nonstop, alone, no outside assistance. The original Sunday Times event, the 2026 Golden Globe race is very simple. Depart from Les Sables, Delaunay, France on September 6, 2026 and sail solo nonstop around the world via the five Great Capes and return to Les Sables, Delaunay. And I'm probably butchering that name.
Is there a reward?
Entrants are limited to sailing similar yachts and equipment that was available to Sir Robin in that first race. That means sailing without modern technology or the benefit of satellite-based navigation aids. Competitors must sail in production boats between 32 and 36 feet, designed prior to 1988, that have full-length keel with rudder attached to their trailing edge.
But what's the reward? That's what we need to know. I mean, I think it's cool that they maintain the integrity of the competition and not allow them to use completely modern technology.
I do not see what...
See, they've learned a lesson. It's not about the destination. It's about the journey and the friends you make along the way. The problem is that those friends are porpoises, not humans.
And the Southern Lights.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap this one up. It won't be that long.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed this story.
Thank you for joining me. I figured I'd give you one that was a little bit less sad.
Yes. We just got to talk about cheetahs.
Cheetahs. And if you would like to know the cheetah facts conversation had to
maybe
do...
Maybe that can be a special.
...with the fact that Sam and his brothers insisted that they would be able to kill a cheetah with their bare hands.
The question was, do you think that you could kill a cheetah? And a cheetah is not a full-sized cat, big cat. So it weighs 60 to 80 pounds. And it does not have sharp claws. It has dull claws because they cannot retract their claws.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
That pit bull that attacked the guy outside of the gym.
Yes.
How much do you think it weighed?
Oh, 40 pounds.
Do you think it could have killed that guy?
Oh, yeah. But we're not saying kill the cheetah every single time. But do I think I have a chance? Yes.
Okay.
Would I kill the cheetah 10 or 20% of the time? Yes.
Okay.
Would I die 80% of the time? Very likely.
Okay. This is a different conversation than what we had previously, but maybe...
I don't think... Okay. If... I never said that I could kill the cheetah 100% of the time. Is that what you remember?
It was implied there was like a guarantee.
I'm not that stupid.
Okay.
I would kill the cheetah sometimes out of 10.
Okay. All right. Well, thank
you. What do you guys think? Tell us in the comments. Could you kill a cheetah with your bare hands?
You can really only
Coliseum
comment on
format?
Spotify or if you join us on...
Follow Kayla on her social media.
Yeah. Instagram, Facebook.
And we'll have a post about this, and only the people that have made it to the end will know.
Good God, if you've made it to the end, thank you so much for being here. And I appreciate you, and I look forward to hearing from you. And stay tuned. We've got a solo episode next week, and then a two-parter later this month. So
go team break.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please take a moment to rate and subscribe from wherever you listen to Tragedy with a View. To get access to ad-free episodes, bonus content, and more, please join us on our Patreon. The link will be in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and to share a story of your own, send us a campfire confessional email at tragedywithaview@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.